You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This American Life host, Ira Glass, is scheduled to talk at Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield tomorrow night. The Big Top was hit hard by a thunderstorm last night, but the show is still on.
If you've listened to This American Life, you know that it's personal. Sometimes it winds its way through places you didn't know it was going to go.
Well, we interviewed Ira Glass last week, and that's pretty much what happened. We went unexpected places, but in the end, it was so much fun and so Ira Glass that we decided to air even the chit-chatty stuff at the beginning that technically wasn't supposed to air.
So, here's Ira Glass talking about Bayfield.
I haven't been to Bayfield. I've been around Wisconsin a bunch.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of Illinois people vacation up there. Now you're in New York, but it is actually really gorgeous.
Are you a Wisconsin native?
I am. Can you tell?
Yes.
I also like cheese.
Me too, though. Honestly, I feel Wisconsin has everything, I have to say. Yeah, yeah. And House on the Rock, of course. When you go to House on the Rock and you go to that Frank Lloyd Wright house that's right nearby, it makes Frank Lloyd Wright seem like a small-minded little troll. No, I'm serious. Like, I feel like it really puts him in perspective.
Well, he was definitely the House on the Rock dude, had a vision, and he went for it.
I know this is a rude question to ask, but is this the interview happening right now?
No,
or is
it's
this
not.
The pre-interview part. Oh, it's not. Oh, this is good, this part. Yeah. I hope you're taping this part.
I'm just trying to make sure if you're worthy of our interview time. No, I'm
noted.
Just... Okay. Anyway.
So did I pass?
You passed. I think we'll proceed.
Okay.
You can appear on the airwaves of Wisconsin Public Radio, which, of course, you already do.
No,
one last
I feel like
note.
I already had my audition. This is the longest 14-year audition in the history of...
And you passed with flying colors.
The Ideas
Congratulations.
Network. Are we on the Ideas Network?
Yeah, it's going to be on the Ideas Network. This is a new show called Central Time. So you're, I guess you're one of our biggest, I don't know, do you like the word star? That's what we might call you.
I
we've had
the
on.
Word get. I'm your, one of your biggest gets.
Okay, you're one of our biggest gets. And one last note.
Are you serious? You're not going to use this part? This part is so nice.
I don't know. Maybe we'll use it. Galen, the producer, is nodding and giving me a thumbs up.
Wait, and who's been the number two biggest get besides me? Or maybe I'm number two, but like, who else has been another big get?
We had Sanjay Gupta. Does he count? Who else did we have,
sure.
Galen?
We had... What's his name?
Oh, we had the guy who played Mufasa on The Lion King on Broadway and got to meet Michael Jackson.
No, and I'm against The Lion King on Broadway.
Oh, see, I got to disagree with you.
Are you serious? Why? Who did you relate to in The Lion King?
Who didn't I relate to in The Lion King?
Are you serious? I felt like I sat through that whole thing thinking, like, who is this for? Like, there's nobody to relate to. Like, oh, I'm really supposed to relate to the story of some, like, you know, some person whose dad was the king and died, and now I'm supposed to be the king. Like, where's the emotional entrance in that?
Well,
like,
you do know it's Hamlet for Disney, right? And who doesn't relate to Hamlet? It's every man.
It's interesting you say that, because I think I have the same problem with Hamlet. I think Hamlet is a bad play.
Okay, well, that's our problem then.
No. I'm not even joking. Like, I think it's an interesting play. Like, I think it's an interesting play, but I don't think it's fun to watch. Like, I don't feel like you get caught up in the characters. I don't.
I have to agree.
I think the average, yeah, like I feel like it's a hard to relate to story where you just feel like, I think as a modern viewer, you just think like, well, dude killed your dad and is sleeping with your mom. Don't go home. like, stay away.
What about like, honor? What about family honor? What about indecision? That's something that plagues all of us. Maybe not you, but the whole thing is about Hamlet waffling back and forth. And should he? Can he? Will he? I think that's compelling.
Again, find it hard to relate to. I mean, we don't have to agree on this. I'm just saying, like, it's not an emotional experience either of those plays for me. I guess I'm trying to think of some sort of thought that could actually make this broadcastable. And the thought that I'm having is the plot of Hamlet or of The Lion King, I don't think could be on an episode of This American Life because there's no one to relate to. Like, they're not good enough for our show. No, I mean, I say that, I'm being facetious, but do you know what I mean? Like they're not right for our show because I feel like we're looking for stories that are more emotional than either of those stories. And emotional specifically, and like you could relate to somebody and you feel really strongly when you watch it or listen to it.
Don't you think that Hamlet and The Lion King are both writ large, though? I mean, The Lion King is a spectacle. And what they're really getting at is ambivalent father-son relationships. And I think about a piece that I heard on This American Life, Sarah Vowell talking about her dad and her problematic relationship with him and how they disagreed about everything. And he wanted to cancel out her Democratic vote with his Republican vote. And yet when she thought about him dying, you know, she ended with a line something like, "I wanted to hurt." I think that's the same thing that Hamlet is.
I think that the ambivalent father relationship in Hamlet is just very different, and it doesn't play out in as relatable way. When the play opens, his dad's a ghost wandering around and showing up at banquets and stuff, and he doesn't have a relatable ambivalence about his dad. He knows how he feels about his dad. He feels loyal to him and wants to avenge him, perhaps. But that's different than what Sarah's going through, where her dad is driving her crazy, but she also loves him, which is the thing that most of us feel about our parents, whether or not we had a dad.
Now, I was just watching an interview you did for Slate, and you talked about your parents and how they, sounds like they hated your idea of going into public radio.
Yeah, yeah. Was your mom into you going into public radio?
My mom's the reason I'm in public radio.
Oh, is that true?
Oh, yeah. It was on, it's still on 24/7 in her house at any given moment.
Wow.
If I walked in, it would be on right now. Whether or not she's doing other things, whether or not she's home, it would be on.
And so do you have the sense of like, oh, well, then I'm going to go on the radio because I'll get her attention?
No, no, actually, it just seemed like a place that felt comfortable and a place where, yeah, I could express sort of who I am and write. I wanted to write, too. What about you?
I mean, I think we're talking about, first of all, we're talking across a generational divide, because when I was a kid, public radio didn't exist in the way it does now. Like, I grew up, I'm 54, and so I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and public radio didn't start to exist as a national network until the early 70s. And at the point where I got a job at NPR in Washington in 1978, like, I had never heard NPR on the air. Like, I walked in the door never having heard it. And most people hadn't heard it. And so it wasn't a thing that like your parents could be playing around the house. And, unless they were listening to kind of one of the old land grant stations and, you know, like Wisconsin Public Radio probably existed before NPR existed, but it was, you know, local shows and statewide shows. And so the things that we think of now as being, public radio really didn't exist, and the identity of it didn't exist. It was just a much different thing. And then my parents, were very much against me doing it because they just felt like you're never going to make any money, you know, and they felt like, and they didn't get it. Like, they would listen to public radio and they just didn't get what was good about it. And so for me, I think if they had been hardcore public radio listeners, I was such a contrarian, child, I would not have gone into public radio. And one of the things that made it possible for me to go into public radio was the fact that it was a place that I knew they would never ever hear me. And then, I mean, that sounds like I'm joking, but I think it's completely true. Like, the fact that they didn't listen was an added bonus, to the whole thing. So I could do my thing by myself without their surveillance. And then when I got older, when I got into my 30s, like, I was ready to be closer to them, and they really did oppose me doing public radio. And when I started This American Life, they were, you know, they tried to be good parents and they would try to be encouraging, you know, and they wished for me the best, but they made very clear, like, they, you know, like, that they thought it was a mistake. And I remember the first, year we were on the air, we won this award that I don't think many people have heard of, but it's kind of a big deal in our world, which is the Peabody Award. So it like is this big broadcasting award, and we all went to New York City, and there was a ceremony at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, and it was very fancy, and fancy people were there, and like famous people, like Lily Tomlin got an award that year, and The Simpsons got an award, and you know, and like Tom Brokaw or Peter Jennings or somebody was the host of the thing and would give you your award, and we got this award for This American Life, like our very first year on the air. My dad was at the table, and I remember we were there, and I remember him saying to Nancy Updike, she reminded me of this recently, one of our producers, during this ceremony, he said to her, like, I still don't see why he's doing this with his life.
Oh, no, that can't be true now. Surely by now.
No, they came around. No, they totally came around. No, they came around. It's funny, like enough of their friends heard the radio show over time. That they came around. And truthfully, like in the early years, they used to have them on the show all the time. And so then they kind of came around on the show. And I think my dad even kind of came around on listening to NPR. Like I think he'll even turn on Morning Edition now. Even knowing that I won't be on that show. Like for a while, their entire public radio listening was simply things that I was on. And then if it was an episode of the show that I wasn't in much, they wouldn't like it. But that was okay, but there wasn't enough of you. And then, but I think they've kind of come around. I remember specifically that like our fifth year on the air, I did some promotion for the show and I went on to the David Letterman show, and I had never been on television before, and it was after that my parents said officially, it's okay if you don't go to med school.
So it was the Letterman seal of honor. It sounds like you're probably one of the only people in the country who went into public radio as a form of rebellion.
It's very sad, but true. Yeah, that's really true.
Is This American Life? I mean, it's not a rebellious show, but you did bust up the format a little bit, and that format has changed the landscape of public radio. I know when I hear you interviewed, you don't always, you know, take a lot of credit for the way public radio has changed, but I mean, surely you can hear that public radio sounds different now, and I think that's in part due to This American Life.
I think it sounds different in small ways around the margins, like on the weekends, on the stations that take The Moth and Radiolab and stuff like that. I feel like you can hear little things, Snap Judgment. But I think, you know, the news shows pretty much are on their own course, and we've had no influence on them at all. Fresh Air continues apace without any influence from us. Garrison Keillor's show seems to do just fine without being influenced by us. I think when you look at the programs that people actually listen to in large numbers, we've had no effect.
I'm going to say yes and no to that. I think you're right, but I also think that if you listen closely and you listen to the way stories reported now, it will be reported in this deliberately conversational style that is intended to sound like a person talking to you instead of a person reading to you from copy. I hear that.
I mean, you hear that? I feel like I wish I heard that more. Is the truth. Like, I like that style. So, I wish I heard it more. I mean, like, you know, there were always reporters who did that. It's not like we invented that on our show. Like, there were always really chatty sounding people on the air on NPR. And then there were people who were stiffs a little bit more, like very good reporters, but kind of stiffs in the way they would perform. And so that was always there. You know, like one of the first hosts of All Things Considered was this woman, Susan Stamberg, who was like the chattiest performer ever.
Coming up, the rest of this interview with Ira Glass of This American Life. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks, Noah. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
We're going to continue listening now to our conversation with This American Life host, Ira Glass.
I'm curious about how close you get to the people who tell these stories.
I mean, for the stories where it seems like you're getting to know a lot of personal stuff, like in some cases, you know, that will be somebody who one of the reporters or I will have spent days with or longer. Though some incredibly intensely personal stuff comes out and just sometimes in these stories, which are just somebody comes in the studio, sits down for an hour, and then they tell some amazingly personal story, and then we, you know, I say thanks so much, and you know, we never speak again. Like that happens all the time.
How does that feel?
I would be a better person if I said that it felt horrible, but in fact, I'm not that good of a person, and it feels a little weird sometimes. Like it does feel a little weird, but you know, like I'm, you know, we're making stuff every week, we're making new stuff every week, And so it's, you know, I understand that the reason why I'm talking to them is not to make them my friend, but to, you know, to have them tell something to people, and they understand that too. So it can be a little weird when it's somebody who you end up spending a week or two with. Like it can be a little weird, but then, you know, like often the people who you end up spending a week or two with, like, you know, you do kind of befriend, like, and you know, you will stay, you know, I do stay in touch with and, you know, have emails every now and then and, you know, hear from.
Well, I imagine starting this show, I mean, I don't even have to ask, but obviously it's changed the shape of your whole life. And Galen, our producer, we were just talking about how our show is 5 weeks old, and there's so much work to do. I don't know. And we were wondering if you felt that same way when you started this American Life in the beginning. Did you know? Yeah, I don't know, do you have any sense about what it would become and what it was like in those early days?
I had no sense of what it would become. Like my goal for the show was just that it would be a nice show. And I thought, like, this is a thing that I like. Like, I like this style of stories, and I think that there's an audience for this. But it's not necessarily, like, a super big audience. And our business plan for the show was to be on something like 65 stations by the end of 2 years. And our early contracts, when we'd have people sign releases, if they wrote a story or something to come on the radio, we just thought, like, well, what's the most impossible, far away? It would be crazy if we would last this long length of time. And those contracts were off for 3 years. And I remember lying in bed, all of us just worked all the time. We worked late nights. We worked weekends. It was a staff of 4 people. And we just worked all the time. We were never not working. If we were awake, we were working or eating. And that lasted for several years. Like that lasted for a few years. And I remember I was a few years into it. I remember in the first year lying in bed one night, and the thought occurred to me, like, in a way that was very visceral, where I just thought, like, wait, I signed up to do this for how long? And then I realized, like, there was no end date on it. Like, it wasn't like a tour of Afghanistan or something where, like, you know, like, oh, I'm going to do this for 6 months or a year, and then I come back. It was just sort of like, oh, I signed up to do this every week. Forever. Like, if it's, you know what I mean? like for the rest of my life, if it can last that long. Like basically, if the show survives, I'm signing up to it. And I was just like, what was I thinking? And then I asked Scott Simon, who does, you know, Weekend Edition Saturday, about this thing that you're asking me about. And I said, like, I'm in the situation where I never am not working on the show. And that's true for everybody on the show. How long is this going to last? And he didn't hesitate, and he said 5 years. It lasts 5 years.
5 years?
5 years. And he was right. It's 5 years. It lasts 5 years.
I don't know if that's encouraging or completely depressing.
Well, at least you know there's an end point.
Well, wait, what happened in 5 years that changed?
At 5 years, we had enough of an audience that it was possible to get underwriting and stations started paying for the show. We basically had more money and we could hire more people. And so we had another, like, 2 more people. And then you're in a different situation because are you weekly or daily?
We're daily.
You're daily.
We're daily, so 3 hours a day.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, we're like a very different thing, but like, you know, for us, 5 years in, we could have reruns. You know what I mean? We had a bank of shows that we could have reruns. We had stations that were then at that point, you know, they would pay to run the show. And so we had more revenue, and basically we could hire a couple of extra people, and it made a huge difference.
I don't know. Do you have any advice obviously our shows are different animals.
I mean, the only thing you can do is amuse yourself. You know, like, that's the only thing you got going for you because, I mean, it's not going to ever pay that much money, and the number of hours you're going to work is going to be crazy. And the main thing that will make it good is the more you're out in a very selfish way to amuse yourself, actually, the better the show will get.
I like that answer. I think we can live
weirdly,
with that.
Like, I find it weird that that's not advice that's given to, like, young journalists. Like that was always kind of my inclination, so I was going there anyway. Like, I didn't need that advice. But I feel like when I talk to journalism students, I feel like there's so much worry that they're not going to get, like, the skills and the basics and be going to be responsible and all that, that nobody tells them, like, if you have fun and follow the things that you're actually curious about, like, everything's going to get more exciting both for you and for the audience. And I feel like somehow that the most important message gets neglected.
So you've got these 500 shows behind you, and as for what's ahead, I've heard you were kicking around the idea of a This American Life musical at one point. Do you sing?
I'm not a singer. I'm not a singer in any sense that anybody would want to hear it.
So people will not hear you singing at the Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield.
Well, I used to say in the promos, I can't remember if I said in the promos for it, like I used to have this line of, like, unlike some other public radio hosts when they come to town, I will not sing. But now I feel like, oh, that's just too mean to Garrison, who I really adore. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seemed funny to me, but now I just feel like, oh, that's snarky. And I didn't mean it to be snarky. I just thought it was a funny thing to say. So no, there will be no singing. I have been dancing. I'm in a dance show now. That starts touring in the fall. Yeah. Yeah, well, to say that I'm dancing, it's more like I'm in a show with two incredible dancers, modern dancers. This is going to sound awful as I say this, but basically I tell stories, they dance, but it's not corny. It's not like, you know, now they are the volcano and now they are the lava going down the volcano.
So it's not a modern interpretation of The Lion King.
No, it's not. It's definitely not that, as you know. Good. My feelings about The Lion King. No, it's two dancers and I tell stories and they dance. And then occasionally a couple times during the show, like, I dance with them. And so I've been in training for that for several months. And you know, like, I'm old. I'm in my 50s. Like, you know, that it actually took quite a doing to get to the point where I can dance on stage with people.
See, that's the problem with radio. No one can see you dancing. Well,
that is not the problem with radio. That's the entire advantage of radio.
Well, Ira, it has been completely unexpected and really great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Good luck with your sixth week.
Thank you. I think I've got the dates wrong, actually. What are we, more like week 8 or something?
Well, good luck, you know, as you head into week 9 and 10. And good luck with your venture. Good luck with the next 4 years minus 10 weeks.
That was Ira Glass, host of This American Life.